You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. So you can access us in real life at our store or virtually at our website, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, iTunes, YouTube, Yelp, Foursquare, Google+, Google Maps, BuzzFeed, StumbleUpon, and obviously other social media outlets of which I know nothing, none of which seems to have generated any footsteps to our door. In any event, it is my pleasure to welcome Sam Keen again to our show. His books are The Disappearing Spoon, an elegiac, tour of the periodic table, The Violinist's Thumb, a romantic interlude with DNA, and of which we spoke of a couple years ago now, in 2012, and now published just last month by Little Brown, The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, a book you will love if somewhere in your cerebral cortex lie or slide about the concepts of neuron, dendrite, axon, and tautologically, the cerebral cortex. Now, if they reside in your hippocampus, then you're going to have to mediate them quickly, and I seriously don't know how into that aforesaid cortex, at least sometime during this interview. So welcome again, Sam, and thanks for coming back to talk to me again. Most authors think once is enough.
Well, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Sure. So what happens to you when you fall asleep on your back, and why?
Well, when I fall asleep on my back, I have a bit of a problem in that I go into a state called sleep paralysis. Basically, what happens is that my mind wakes up, but my body remains asleep. Sort of the opposite of sleepwalking, which is where your body's awake, but your mind's asleep. Here, my mind's awake, my body's not. And so I'm lying there. I can hear things going on around me. I know that there's light coming into the curtains, maybe, but I can't move at all. I can't move a pinky or nostril or even anything. I'm just sort of paralyzed lying there. And it's really kind of a horrific state to be in. You feel like you're trapped inside your own body. But I realize that it actually provides some interesting insight into the way that the brain works. Because it turns out it's a byproduct of dreaming. When we're dreaming, the pons, the structure in the brain that sort of regulates our sleep and wake cycles, it actually sends signals down into your spinal cord, and it tells your spinal cord not to allow your body to move. It basically paralyzes you. You know, that's kind of for your own benefit, so you're not taking swings at monsters in your dreams and things like that. It turns out, though, that in people who experience sleep paralysis, when they sort of wake up from this, normally their bodies do wake up as well. But every once in a while, something goes wrong, and their bodies just don't wake up.
Keeping along with your personal experiences, because I think they're really interesting, and in my mind, it may have given rise in part to your book. Tell us a little bit about mercury when you were a kid, because I have a story too.
Okay. Yeah, nothing gets people telling stories like mercury.
I know.
This is a tale from my first book, The Disappearing Spoon, which is sort of a romp through the periodic table. And basically, what happened was I would be sick. I came down with strep throat something like a dozen times one year in school. And every time I stayed home, my mother would put one of those old-fashioned mercury thermometers beneath my tongue. And I admit I was a little, you know, clumsy when I was a kid, also a little prone to talking to myself, and not infrequently, the thermometer would fall on our hardwood floor, and it would break. But my mother was actually very cool about the whole thing. She never, you know, panicked or made us leave the house or anything. She would actually get down, and she would brush the little spheres of mercury together. And I just thought it was the most fascinating substance I'd ever seen. And it really got me interested in the elements for the first time. I was looking at this beautiful, beautiful substance, mercury. And we got quite a nice collection of it over the years as I broke more and more thermometers.
Well, it's funny because I want to tell you, albeit with some type of dread, I kind of am in a Benjamin Rush kind of situation. Because,
oh, yeah?
Yeah, because my uncle was a dentist. So he gave us this big vial of mercury. And we, I mean, a big vial. And we used to, like, drop it on the floor and roll it around. And then we'd experiment with it, my brother and I, and put it in the freezer, for God's sakes, to see if it would freeze. And probably...
Did you actually get it to freeze?
No.
Okay, I didn't think so.
but then we handled it, and I guess we handled our food. We didn't wash our hands, so... Mm-hmm. And it doesn't metabolize, right?
Oh, your body actually will get rid of it. so... If you swallow and ingest mercury, you know, it's a poison. You don't want that in your body, and your body will sort of flush you out. Maybe even to the point where some people, if they ingest it, they have problems because it goes through them too quickly. What's really dangerous about mercury is the fumes. The fumes are the things that cause danger, brain damage, stuff like that. And, you know, it's not exactly good for you if you ingest it, but usually if you ingest it, your body can get rid of it. So I think you might be safe. I don't know.
Thanks. That's really a vote of confidence. well, actually, you know, Dr. Benjamin Rush is a cool guy. He really helped with the revolution, and he was a nice person. But why don't you tell just briefly, and then we'll move on, about what Benjamin Rush did with mercury, you know, around the country, essentially.
Yeah, basically, he thought mercury was the greatest substance ever for medicine, and he invented these pills. He called them Dr. Rush's bilious pills. They were each about four times the size of an aspirin, so very, very large pills. And, you know, there's really no delicate way to put it. They were extremely powerful laxatives. They called them thunderclappers. And the idea was that if you ate something you shouldn't or drank some questionable water or something like that, you could take one of these and they would flush you out completely. And they were so well known that he actually packed 600 of these off with Lewis and Clark when they went through the wilderness. And we know that Lewis and Clark used them even because it's had sort of an unusual side benefit for historians and archaeologists, and that they can actually pinpoint a few places where they know Lewis and Clark must have stayed because the level of mercury in the soil is just too high for it to have been natural. So Dr. Rush's pills ended up benefiting historians many hundreds of years later inadvertently.
That's amazing. Let's talk a little bit about, to get started, let's talk a little bit about people that everybody knows, and then we can move on to like Vesalius and the Fabrica. But if you talk a little bit about the poor situation, I mean, poor President Wilson and what happened to him and his attempt to get the League of Nations through Congress and partially why he couldn't.
Yeah, so around the end of World War I, Woodrow Wilson was a big driving force behind the League of Nations, and he was facing opposition in the Senate. So he decided he was going to go on this big tour to try to rally support among the people. And his doctor actually advised him not to go on this. Wilson had been suffering from, you know, headaches, vertigo, stuff like that. And he'd actually had a few small strokes early in his administration, but just sort of pushed through them, kept going. Well, this time he pushed himself too far, ended up having a pretty big stroke when he was between Colorado and Kansas. And at that point, he actually went back to the White House and had to convalesce for a long time. And no one really knew how bad he was, to the point where he was pretty much incapacitated. His wife kind of took over as president for quite a while, and they cut all the cabinet members out, they cut the vice president out. It's really kind of a strange situation, and really no one knew how bad he was. The interesting thing, though, neurologically, was that he came down with a very unusual symptom. Unusual being rare, but it is a well-recognized symptom in that he suddenly stopped noticing everything to the left side of his body. So if you were to walk up to him on the right side, he would say hello, he would greet you. If you were to come up to him on the left side, he would ignore you completely. He just would not pay any attention to you. Or if he was looking for a pen on his desk, maybe, anything on the right side he could get, but something on the left side he could not get. And what was really weird about it was that it wasn't so much vision, because it's not like his eye wasn't working or something like that. Because if you explicitly pointed something out on his left side, he would say, oh, okay, I see that. But if you didn't explicitly point it out, he just wouldn't pay attention. So it wasn't vision so much as it was him, his ability to pay attention to things on his left side. It's a symptom called hemispatial neglect. And again, it's rare. It doesn't happen that often, but it's a well-recognized symptom. And I don't think many people realize that Wilson was suffering from this and other neurological symptoms while he was actually purportedly running the United States.
It was fascinating that I had known that his wife was essentially President pro tem, but it's interesting how, in a nice way, how she sabotaged his campaign for an unprecedented third term.
Yeah, and that's the other thing about hemispatial neglect often is, you know, when you have other neurological disorders, like if you can't speak or often, you know, if your hand is paralyzed, something like that, you realize it and you realize, I need some help. When you have hemispatial neglect, a lot of times you don't realize it, that there's anything wrong. In fact, you insist you're fine. Wilson, in this case, said, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm perfectly, perfectly fine, even though he was suffering this and other symptoms. And his wife, however, and one of his advisors realized that, no, he's actually not okay. And when he tried to run for a third term, they went to the Democratic National Convention that year and actually started spreading the truth. It sounded like rumors, but they were actually spreading the truth that he was not in any shape to run, and that the delegates should throw their support behind someone else. And eventually they did, without Wilson really being aware of what was going on behind the scenes there, that his wife and advisor were kind of sabotaging the whole thing.
And that segues nicely into the story, again, kind of tragic, of William O. Douglas, the longest-serving Supreme Court justice, who's on this jaunt to the Bahamas with his in his 70s with his 30-some-year-old wife.
Right.
And he's... Which, you know, maybe I'll be able to, I don't know. But
you wonder why it happened when he had a 30-year-old wife, yeah.
But he had the same situation where he thought nothing was wrong with him, and he would still go to court, and as you said, he called himself the 10th Justice and things like that. Tell a little bit about that one, because it's similar in the sense that both of them still thought executively that they could function as they did before.
Yeah, so again, Douglas was having problems with one half of his body. Left half of his body was completely paralyzed. So he was in even worse shape than Wilson was. His mind was also sort of foggy. He was losing track of facts, forgetting names, things like that. Not someone you want to be deciding major cases at this point. And you know, this was after 30-some years on the court. He'd done his work. He created his legacy. There was no real reason for him to hold on, except he was convinced in his own mind that he was okay. And, you know, you could argue about whether your judgment's being clouded, something like that. You'd think, though, that the fact that you're paralyzed would be pretty cut and dry. But even this, he would dispute to people. Reporters would ask him about his leg, you know, how it was doing, whether he was ever going to be able to walk again. And he would deny that there was any problem. He'd be sitting there in a wheelchair, and he would tell them there was no problem, he was just tired, he was resting his leg. At one point, he claimed that he was going to try out for the Redskins, and that he had been actually kicking field goals with his paralyzed leg that morning. He was completely serious. There was just something in his mind that would not allow him to think of himself as paralyzed, to the point where he was confabulating, just making stories up in this sort of desperate attempt to convince people that he was okay.
And it's funny because I remember him as being my favorite Supreme Court justice, and I remember the time, you know, with Gerald Ford, and he didn't want to leave because he didn't want Gerald Ford to appoint a much more conservative justice. Which
Ford was sort of his nemesis. When Ford was Speaker of the House, Ford tried to impeach him for various things. And I think Douglas's words were he thought Ford would appoint some bastard to the court, and he didn't want that to happen. And so Douglas actually ended up sticking around, and even when the other judges finally kind of forced him out, he kept showing up, called himself the 10th Justice. He would commandeer their clerks to do research. He kept trying to cast votes. He just refused to believe that he had been compromised at all by the stroke that he suffered.
It's amazing. And what's amazing is that, you know, all of us only have empirically what's in this wetware inside our heads, 3 or 4 pounds or whatever. And, you know, who's to know? I mean, we all could find ourselves in that situation. And as long as we're in a situation where we deny these things, who's to say, there's no one to say we're wrong, right? I mean, it's all internal.
Yeah, one of the real amazing things about the brain is its ability to sort of explain away problems or to kind of convince itself that there's nothing wrong. That's something that pops up over and over in the book, is the ways that people trick themselves, how their brain sort of, you know, in some ways it's working for their interest, but it does so by, you know, lying to yourself or convincing you of specious reasoning, things like that. The brain is very, very clever, but it doesn't always use its cleverness to promote the truth. It's, you know, more interested in self-preservation, survival, things like that.
Yeah, I always try and look at these things like evolutionarily, like what would be the point of giving up? You know, there's no upside to giving up. You might as well continue to proceed as if you were okay. You might have
a shot.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah. So I'm always interested in epigraphs, and yours is from Macbeth, and it's, the times have been that when brains were out, the man would die, and there an end. But now they rise again, which seems to suggest, if that's a gnomon for the entire book, that you do have, unlike the dig you give to Dawkins, some spiritual aspect to your understanding of the brain-mind. Is that... No, you tell me why you chose that, then.
Well, I was actually looking at it in a little different way, because most of the cases in the book, it's about people getting injured or something like that. And if you look back, you know, even 200 years ago, which isn't that long when you look at the entire span of human history, most of the people in the book probably would have died. The stroke would have killed them. The tumor would have killed them. The accident would have killed them. And they would not have survived to live another day or to kind of reveal what their... I should back up. They would not have been able to survive, basically. And because they would not have survived, they would not kind of reveal these amazing symptoms to us. So it's basically modern medicine that allowed us to save these people. But because we saved these people, now we have to suddenly deal with the consequences of brain injuries. And so really it's only the fact that we're able to save them that we're able to see these injuries. And the Macbeth line was talking about how, you know, it used to be people got hit in the head or something, and that would be the end of them. But nowadays, they rise again. And because they rise again, we have to deal with the consequences of this.
Well, what?
No, I wasn't actually thinking about the spiritual at all, but that's an interesting spin on it.
Well, I can ask you straight out. I mean,
yeah.
you decide you're going to joke about Dawkins, and you say there's not a spiritual bone cell in his body. And I've heard, you know, we've all heard him talk over and over again about his feelings. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about it?
I'm not a religious person, so I don't think that there's any sort of entity in ourselves that lives on afterward. I do think, though, that there are, you can't figure out what's going on in our brain just by looking at the level of individual cells. Everything is based in cells, I believe, in a material basis for the mind, but you're not going to be able to reduce it to just the chirps of cells. There's something we're not understanding about what's going on. And I think it's all a physical process, but there is something we're not quite grasping, something kind of bigger, something that emerges when you get lots and lots of these cells working together. And I'm not someone who thinks that we should, you know, kind of stay away from this because we'll explain away all the mystery, all the poetry, all the lovely things about being a human being. I don't think that'll happen. I think we'll actually find more and more interesting things out, and that there will always still be mysteries out there. So, you know, we might not get to the end of this. We might not figure out everything about consciousness or free will to our complete satisfaction. But I do think that we should keep pushing and keep trying to find these things out.
Well, if you go back in your book to the idea of the Egyptians and the idea of the seat of the soul being the heart, and, you know, how would you scrape the entire brain out through someone's nose? I can't imagine that.
So this was an ancient Egyptian practice. They believed that the heart was the part of the body that did the thinking. And in some ways, you know, it kind of makes sense. The heart's in the center of the body. The heart reacts more quickly. You know, if we're scared of something, our heart starts beating fast, which, you know, would kind of imply that it's involved in the thinking or whatever, whereas our brain doesn't do much. It just sort of sits there phlegmatically, not doing anything. So the Egyptians believed that the heart and the other organs were the really important part, and they decided after someone died, they were going to get rid of the brain. And as you said, what they did basically is they put an iron hook up to their nose. They would break the bones, they were thinner at that point. They would break through the bones, and they would basically drag the brain out bit by bit. And it sounds like a very laborious process, and I'm sure it was. It's actually helped along by the fact that the brain is much softer than I think most people realize. It actually has the consistency of a ripe avocado. So you could take a spoon even and just scoop brain tissue out. So I don't think people realize how soft it is, and so they were probably able to get it out that way because it is very soft, and you know, then wash it out with something, try to stick a rag up there, something like that, and clean the brain out from the inside. So that was the Egyptian sort of mythology about what happened to our bodies after death, is that we didn't need our brain.
It's kind of like carving out a pumpkin with just a tiny little hole in the top instead of putting the big hole in it. But that'd be that, be that as it may, I'll tell you what I did do, though. I went out and bought tapioca to eat it because you said the brain had the consistency of tapioca. And,
right.
But it seems like that's way too soft. How can you have convolutions if you have something that's soft? And then how can it survive the contra coup kind of concussion if it's all mushy like that?
Well, the brain does have membranes around it, so it has something holding it in, and there's a few membranes, in fact, so they're all kind of keeping it in one place. And, you know, if you thought about something like avocado, you could sculpt avocado. You could make it into a shape, something like that. And if you do that, it will sort of stay in its place. It won't, you know, it'll jiggle around, it'll move, it could get easily damaged, but it can sort of stay in its place. There's also, you know, blood vessels kind of running through there, which can create some of the furrows, things like that. So with the combination of the membranes, the blood vessels running through, other things like that, it can keep its shape, roughly.
I guess that's true. If you think about an egg, you can throw it down a hill and the shell's going to stay intact and there's still going to be a yolk in it. You're right.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a good. That's another good example.
Well, so if that's the case, I mean, tell us a little bit more about the blood-brain barrier, because that's a concept that must be hard for people to understand.
Yeah, basically, you have this barrier between the blood in your body and your brain. If you look down at the level of cells, it's a special set of cells that basically are gatekeepers. They don't allow a lot into the brain. Obviously, they allow some things. They allow glucose. They allow other nutrients, things like that. But most of the things that try to get into the brain cannot get into the brain, which is good for the most part. You know, if you have an infection in your blood, the blood-brain barrier will keep out most infections. It won't allow them through. Some sort of poison in your blood, it won't allow it through. So, you know, if you eat something, it goes into your stomach, obviously, first. It can easily get into your liver, your kidneys, other places. You're going to have a much harder time getting into the brain. So it's mostly protective, except that it can cause some problems when it comes to drug delivery, because there's a lot of ailments we know what's going on in the brain. Something like Parkinson's, we know it's caused by the destruction of dopamine-producing cells inside our brain. So the obvious solution would be to give us dopamine and kind of pump our brains back full of dopamine. One of the problems with that, though, is that dopamine can't cross the blood-brain barrier. So suddenly this becomes a problem because you can't get drugs easily into the brain. So it's not something that was a big deal. I mean, was protective for most of our human history. But nowadays, it has become a problem with modern medicine.
You know, a lot of the book is really funny, and it seems like you really have a lot of fun writing them, especially the footnotes. And you do, don't you? I mean, you really seem to enjoy writing these books more so than many
others. They're a delight to write. You know, every day just plowing into new articles, new books I've read, just talking to people about the science. It's really amazing the kind of things that are out there if you just keep digging and keep finding new stories. And I really did want to base the book in stories. That's what it's all about. It's just telling good, funny, unusual, spooky stories. And I just want to kind of get some of that enthusiasm across when I'm writing. So yeah, it's as fun to write as you know, anything I've ever done. I really enjoyed having the chance to write all these books.
I know, and it really comes through. But at the same time, there's, and I don't even know whether you mean it to be, but there's some poignant moments. And one that I remember specifically, and I've forgotten the names, the doctor whose sister had the tumor that was
Wilder pushed. Penfield.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was really poignant when you pointed out that the tumor, which was pressing against, basically pushing her eyes outward, it was so generously supplied with blood through these blood vessels that supplied the tumor as if they were supplying a really healthy part of the body. That was scary to me.
Yeah, so Wilder Penfield was American, then he became a Canadian neurosurgeon, very, very famous, very well known, and he ended up operating on his sister because he said, I'm one of the best neurosurgeons in the world, and I don't trust anyone else with her. That's not something that would probably allow today, but at the time, the 1930s, they didn't have all these regulations in place that they do now, so he was actually able to operate on his sister. And the really spooky part about the whole thing is that for most brain surgeries of the type he was doing, and this is true even today, a lot of people are actually awake during neurosurgery. So they're talking with the doctor, they're interacting with people, they're perfectly conscious even while their brain's being operated on. So he was operating on his sister while she was awake, looking at her brain, and he had to, you know, decide basically, how much of her brain do I cut out? I know I'm going to be doing some damage to her. How much am I willing to damage? How far am I willing to go in an effort to save her life? So it was a really, I think it was a poignant moment where he had to decide all these things while his sister's brain was open in front of him and all the choices that he had to face. So there were a lot of times in the book where you were confronting these really poignant moments where, you know, parents couldn't recognize their children anymore, or the story of Wilder Penfield. And I did want to kind of give scope to those moments, too, because when you're talking about the brain, you know, you're dealing with these really tough subjects sometimes, really big, important things, and some of that will be tragic.
Yeah, I mean, even more so in that moment, in that operation, the fact that he thought he had done a great job, and then he sees this little tendril of a tumor in the lower corner, that he's just so shattered by that, and he tries to get it, and he overdoes it. You know, that's it was just really sad.
Yeah, there was a huge, huge tumor, as you said, and there was a little tiny tendril of it that was just going out of sight. It just went too deep, where his instruments couldn't quite get at it to remove it, and he tried to get it out, ended up severing a blood vessel, had to stop it up, ended up saving her life, but shut her up knowing that he didn't get all the tumor out and that it was going to grow back someday. It was absolutely devastating for him. It was the first time he'd really kind of been whipped in his life, and it had to be here while he was operating on his sister.
Yeah. Also, you know, like when you say you bring the other thing I wanted to mention was you were talking about stories and what happens with your book. Well, first of all, you can read the footnotes as you're reading along, or you can almost read the footnotes as a standalone book because they're really fun, and you get more informal in your footnotes and joke a little bit more. It's funny because you end up, like I end up at TED Talks or Wikipedia, and listen to one by Antonio Damasio. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether he differs from you, but I couldn't really tell. He was talking about, like, consciousness arises in the brain stem, like it might arise for other living creatures like cetaceans and your dog. And I don't know whether you agree with that or not. Do you?
Well, I would say that you can't pin consciousness down to one place in the brain. There are obviously parts of the brain that are more involved with consciousness than other parts. And we know this because if certain parts get damaged, you might go into a vegetative state, or your consciousness might go on the blink or something like that. But I'm actually kind of doubtful of any explanation for any complicated function in the brain that tries to pin it down to one specific point, whether it's consciousness, language, memory. All of those things are really distributed throughout the brain. And there are certainly parts of the brainstem that are very important for consciousness, that regulate whether we're awake or asleep or how close of attention we're paying to something. But I don't think you can pin it down and say that this is the part of the brain that gives rise to consciousness by itself, as if, you know, none of the rest of the brain is really involved with that. Well, so my guess is, you know, he was kind of more of a popular talk, just kind of reaching a lay audience and was simplifying a little bit.
Well, you're reaching a lay audience, too. Like I said at the beginning, I mean, that's what's so good about all three of these books is they're accessible. And if you want to delve deeper, obviously you can, but they're accessible. And it's funny because, you know, that we're talking about this because you have that one footnote where you say, if you don't read if you don't read anything else, if you don't do anything in this book, read this footnote. And that's basically where you're saying, look, you can't localize anything. It's the whole brain.
Yeah, I think I said something like, if you forget, you know, the title of the book, my name, whatever else, just please remember this one thing. And part of the book is to educate people so that I think when you get done with the book, you're going to have a good understanding of how all the parts of the brain work, how the brain works together, how its parts work together, all those kind of things. But I also wanted to make sure that people, when they read about a new study in the news or when they hear about some new project going on, they'll be able to, you know, feel like they understand what's going on a little bit more. I really wanted to make sure that it would be useful for them going forward. And so that was one of the things I really wanted to kind of get across, because I think that is something that's often overlooked when these studies come out and we say, you know, there's one spot in the brain that gives us, you know, this trait or this trait. It's almost certainly a simplification, and if we know that, we can be a little more skeptical and probably understand what's going on to a greater extent.
Well, that's funny, because if you take a concept, or actually an illustration, of which there are many in your book and the rebuses too, but you know, all of us, even from high school, junior high school, we all have that picture in our mind of that homunculus that shows the portions of the brain that give their most of their space to various parts of the human body, especially the hands and the facial muscles. But what happens is, well, why don't you explain that homunculus, but then explain how you amplify on it so you do what you want to do in the book, which is to educate people. Because you can just look at that thing and you have an idea. But what you do is try to explain a little bit more about why that happens.
Yeah, so the homunculus is basically this sculpture of a human. And if you look at it, it looks like it's very distorted. It has enormous hands, enormous lips, enormous feet, and then these little tiny pencil legs, very tiny torso, something like that. So it looks like, you know, some sort of artistic statement or something. What it really is it's explaining how much how much of our brain we dedicate to running various parts of the body. So your hands, they're not large in comparison to other parts of your body, but they take up a lot of nerve bandwidth because you have to move them in very delicate ways. They're also very sensitive to pain, touch, things like that. Whereas your legs, you imagine your thighs, they're big and powerful, but the movements they do aren't that complicated. You know, you're taking a step, you're kicking something. So you don't actually need to dedicate much of your brain to running your legs the way you do your hands. So on this homunculus sculpture, the hands are very big because it takes a lot of brain to run it. Whereas the legs and the trunk and other things are very small because it doesn't take a lot of brain power to run those things. And what you can get from this is an insight into, again, how important some parts of the body are. Human beings are very involved with our hands. We use them even when we're speaking. We're talking on the phone right now, but I'm using my hands right now to draw things just because I want to express myself through my hands. That's just the way human beings are. I also use the homunculus to talk about phantom limbs. and the way that we can explain some of what's going on with phantom limbs. It seemed very mysterious. You know, if you have your arm cut off, you shouldn't be able to feel your arm afterward. You shouldn't be able to move it. You shouldn't feel pain in it. But people do experience these things. But if you look at how the brain is organized, the brain maps, things like that, and you look at the homunculus, you can kind of see, oh, this is where it comes from. It kind of makes sense that way.
Yeah, and then the brain rewires itself to a certain extent. So a lot of what you – actually, I read a book, and you talk about even orgasm. I read a book where the woman felt the pleasure of orgasm in her earlobes. And so what you say is a lot of the stuff that would be normally devoted to a missing hand, the brain says, you know, well, we don't need this anymore. We're going to take it over.
Yeah, so if you look at your brain map isn't organized the way your body map is. So, for instance, on your brain, the parts of that control the movement and the sensations in your face just happen to be, for whatever reason, right next to the parts that control your hand. So if you lose a hand, if it gets amputated or accident, something like that, the face parts will kind of take over the hand part. And because of that, you know, it will start to use these hand circuits for other things. But there's still kind of some residual hand, you know, essence or hand circuitry in that hand part. So even though it's being used mostly for something else, it still, you know, sort of gives you a tingle or a twinge or sort of a phantom sensation of having a hand. So basically what happens is the face territory takes over the hand territory, uses it mostly for its own ends, but there's a little bit of residual hand feeling there. So every time you're moving your lips or scratching your face with your other hand, something like that, you're sort of re-evoking these old, almost but not quite extinct hand circuits. And I think that goes a long way to explaining where phantom limbs come from.
Now, you talk a lot about you talk in metaphors a lot in the book because that's the only way people, pretty much everybody, can understand what's going on. And you talk about how the metaphor of the brain has changed and how, I guess, like the most recent one before now was the idea of a switchboard. And people can understand that. They can see it. They can see the plugs being, you know, the old microphone plugs being plugged in one and the operator sitting in front of it.
Right.
Yeah. But you just used the term bandwidth, which I don't even know if you used it in the book. Did you use it in the book?
I might have used it somewhere. I probably used it at some point. I didn't rely on it too much. But, you know, metaphors are the way human beings understand everything. Even scientists talk in metaphors sometimes, you know, especially when they're just learning a subject. So I don't think there's any reason to shy away from them because, again, even scientists use them. And it's just the way we understand things. We understand one thing in terms of something else. So they are a good tool to kind of get you into a subject and help you to learn, and they can be fun as well. Sort of the, as you said, the old idea of the brain was like one of those old telephone switchboards where you had an operator, as you said, like moving the plugs around. Nowadays, kind of a more current model is of the brain as a computer. You often hear that. And that's kind of the, as you said, the reigning model of, or the reigning metaphor for the way the brain works.
Yeah, it's funny. Even like if you think about quarks, you know, there is no up, down, strange, charmed. It's just Richard Feynman, those guys just decided to call them that. But in your mind, you do think it's up. You do think it's down.
Yeah, you kind of have to put colors on quarks or things like that, which, you know, that's so far removed from having color or up or down or anything. I mean, there's no way for us to grasp that, but we have to do something with it to kind of help make sense of it, and so we kind of grasp after these metaphors.
And it's funny, those metaphors sometimes become distorted. And you talk a lot about synesthesia, which is such a cool thing, and at what point in my life, kind of akin to Dr. Hoffman's experiments, I experienced synesthesia to a great extent, where colors were sounds, and sights were, you know, taste, and it seemed perfectly natural to me and wondrous in a way. So maybe you could explain a little bit about how, you know, how cross circuits occur.
Yeah, so synesthesia is basically when two senses kind of blend together in this really trippy kind of fun way, so that you're seeing colors when you hear a note, or you are, you know, suddenly numbers appear as bright colors, things like that. So it's really just, again, a combination of different senses. And some people just experience this as a matter of course. It's just the way they're brought up, the way their brain works, because there's cross-wiring between the different senses in their brain. And actually, often they feel kind of sorry for the rest of us because we don't experience this rich, amazing world that they are able to experience.
Yeah, look at those guys that can memorize pi to 10,000 digits, and part of the reason they do is because they see the numbers in a completely different way than we do, so it's easy for them.
Yeah, Daniel Tammet is the guy who did that. He is synesthesia, so he can see numbers and colors. And when he sees blocks of numbers, he sees them in different colors. So that's sort of a mnemonic device. It helps him to memorize lots of digits of pi because he's not just looking at these bare numbers. He's looking at patterns, colors. He sees it more like, you know, you would see a painting of some sort.
Yeah, it's funny because you also talk a little bit about kind of a spare, in the sense of minimalist, synesthesia. And I have that because I've always thought, you know, in terms of, like, for example, days of the week. Mondays were light green, Tuesdays were light brown, Wednesdays were dark green, Thursdays were dark brown.
Yeah.
Do you do that?
No. I am one of these schlubs who has no synesthesia whatsoever. I wish I hadn't. But the only thing I've ever experienced like that was, do you remember those colored ketchups that came out a while ago?
Yeah.
They would make this is a little off on a tangent, but they made these colored ketchups, and when I heard about them, I thought, wow, that's really cool. I like ketchup a lot, so I thought it'd be fun to kind of mix it up, and I tried them, and I'm not someone with a weak stomach at all. I have a pretty hearty appetite, but I just found them so disgusting.
Yeah.
I could not stand them. For some reason, the color, because it was wrong, I just got this feeling of disgust. It really put me off. So something about the color was affecting my taste there. So I don't know if it's quite synesthesia, but that's about as close as I've ever been to it.
Yeah, they had an experiment once where they took a really nice steak, but they put green food coloring on it, and like 99% of the people wouldn't even touch it.
Yeah, I think I heard about this in terms of they had people in this laboratory setting where they had really odd lighting. So it looked kind of like this really trendy modern restaurant. And they were doing things like dyeing their steaks green, changing the colors of mashed potatoes, things like that. And when the lighting was weird, people were eating fine. It was just normal. And then they turned the actual lights on so it looked so they could see what they were eating. And, you know, people were getting up and running to the bathroom. They were just disgusted with what they'd been eating. So it's really odd how that works.
Have you heard about those restaurants where they turn all the lights off and all the waiters are blind? There's one in Israel, and so you don't. Go ahead.
I have heard about it. I haven't done much. I didn't know where there were any of them. There's one in Israel.
Yeah, there's one in Israel. I think there's actually one where I am in Philadelphia, and I know there's one in New York. I would like to try it, but it kind of is a little scary to me. I don't know why. What was I going to ask you next about? I was going to ask you about, again, something that's familiar to people, because I think those are the kind of things that, I don't know, sell books, and that's what we're here to do. So if you talk about the assassination, but yeah, and it's so funny, if you talk about the assassinations of Garfield and McKinley, just like the Civil War, why don't you talk a little bit about how the Civil War and wars in general give rise to these incredible advances in medicine, although it's, albeit, you know, the tragedy and the horror and the pain that is caused by war.
Yeah, so obviously wars have a huge medical cost. There's a lot of destruction, a lot of people's lives ruined, and their health ruined. But it's also the case that wars have ended up in the long run benefiting medicine a lot. The Civil War, we learned a lot about, building more hospitals with fewer infections, or we wouldn't spread infections, things like that. We learned a lot about amputating limbs. We also learned a lot about phantom limbs because there were suddenly so many amputations, more amputations than doctors had ever dealt with before, way more of these amputations. So suddenly we were getting insights into things like how phantom limbs work from the fact that there were so many more of these cases suddenly due to basically advances in weapons during the Civil War. So overall, and you know, it's not just the Civil War, World War One, for instance, we learned a lot about facial injuries, about things like that. Korea and Vietnam, we learned a lot about vascular surgery, about fixing blood vessels, other things like that. So every war that comes along, we learn about something new in medicine. So it's kind of a tragic situation, but wars have ended up benefiting medicine overall in the long run.
The only thing I found really funny in that one chapter was the doctor who contaminated himself and his buddy when he was amputating, and Florence Nightingale saying it was the only operation she'd ever seen that had a 300% mortality rate.
Yeah, this very clumsy doctor who he ended up killing three people during one surgery.
But the funniest thing was I never in my mind as a kid and now could imagine Florence Nightingale having a sense of humor. I don't know.
Yeah, you don't think about her as being, you know, a quick wit or anything.
No.
That was a pretty good line.
It was. Oh. The other fascinating thing about the Civil War was when you explained the difference between the tiny Russian bullet that can pass through a brain and you can determine exactly the lesion that's either caused or the what's taken out because of that brain versus the mini balls. Is that how they're pronounced?
I think it's minier. If you were French, but soldiers during the Civil War called them mini balls.
So explain how that changed and made it much worse for people who were shot by those, basically a hollow point kind of, or what would be now called a hollow point.
Yeah, so these were special kind of bullets made of lead that it was much easier to load them, was basically the advantage of these bullets. Being made of lead, though, unfortunately, when they hit something, lead's a fairly soft metal, you can mold it very easily. When they hit something, they would deform, they would widen out, and so they would end up doing a lot more damage to tissue overall than they would have if they had stayed together. Whereas the next, one of the next major international conflicts, the Russo-Japanese War, which took place about 35 years later or so, they developed much smaller, much harder bullets that, in fact, even when they went through the skull, they would go straight through it and leave a very nice, clean track. So people ended up surviving, but again, because they ended up surviving, they had to deal with some of the brain damage that was involved with being shot through the head. So in this case, because it was very small, very clean tracks, they were able to learn a lot about what different parts of the brain did based just on where the holes were and what the soldiers were experiencing afterward, how their behavior changed. Specifically in this case, they learned a lot about how vision works in the brain, because a fair number of them ended up getting shot in the part of the brain that controls vision. So really our first insight into how we see things, how our mind is able to, you know, make sense of the world visually.
So I'll let you go after this one last question. If your book had another chapter, a last chapter or an epilogue in which you said, okay, first you did your little rebus, but if you said, okay, this is what I think is going to happen in the next 30 years, and I'm still hanging on to this idea, I can't help it, of finding the seat of consciousness, what would you think would be the next thing that's, where are we going now, and what will be the next, for example, what will be the next metaphor, if there is one?
I think we are going to get a better sense. I think consciousness is the thing that's going to be kind of the next interesting frontier, in that we are going to have a better sense of its biology, how it is based in the brain, things like that. So probably something on consciousness.
Do you think that we'll be able ever to either emulate in a Turing machine type of, or Douglas Hofstadter type way, either create artificial intelligence or emulate it to an extent that human beings can't understand the difference between?
I think we would be able to approach it. I don't think the brain would work on a computer because I don't think you can separate the brain from the body. I don't think anything on a computer would work like our brains do because it lacks a body, and our brains aren't isolated. They do have very close connections with the body, and part of the way they understand the world is through the body. So I don't think you'd be able to replicate a human brain on a computer. I don't see any reason why we couldn't produce something that was conscious with a machine, though. It would be a different kind of consciousness than a human being has. But maybe not that different. I still think you could produce something that is conscious.
In the sense of being self-aware, aware of its own existence.
Right, exactly.
Okay. All right, well, let's leave it there. I really enjoyed this one like I did the last one. What do you think your next one? Well, so we've gone from the periodic table to DNA to the function and nature of the brain. And every 2 years you come out with a new one, so you must be working on one now.
I'm actually talking with my editor about that. We're trying to come up with a topic, but we haven't nailed anything down yet. So, still working on it.
I wonder what's left. Sex? You could do sex. It'll sell. I don't know. Well, in any event, thank you so much. And when the next one does come out, I hope you will come back and talk to us again. It's always a pleasure.
I'd love to. That'd be fantastic.
That was Sam Keen talking about his latest book, which, you know, the first two books were great, and he's kind of delved into all kinds of things. The first one was The Disappearing Spoon, which was a tour of the periodic table. And the thing is, it makes it simple for people to understand. And as long as you have the basis, almost rudimentary knowledge regarding these things, what he does is he builds on that basis that you have in a very gentle way so that you end up kind of understanding. The Violinist's Thumb, which was dealt with DNA, and now this, which is maybe my favorite, The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, which, as I said, if you know a little bit about the brain, if you remember from biology or if you like reading popular science books, it really gives you a good idea of how the brain is structured and how the cerebellum interacts with the cerebral cortex, interacting with the amygdala, interacting with the hypothalamus, the brainstem, the limbic system. And so you have a pretty good idea, and it really is an educational process, and it leads you to other things, like I was saying to him, to Wikipedia, to TED Talks, to other books, which I always think is a great legacy for an author to have. Even if you go back to J.K. Rowling's and the Harry Potter books, yes, they're wonderful books, but the main thing is they lead you to read more, and that's what I'm all about. That's what the bookstore is all about, and it's never going to go away because you know, you are holding the author in your hands when you read, and there's a certain serendipity about what you pick and what you choose to read and how it increases the knowledge you have of the world. And isn't that what we're here for anyway, is to increase our knowledge of how the world works? And, you know, next week, it's really interesting. We're going to have this author, and I read this book in the ARC, which is the advanced reader copy, had a really cool cover, which I'm thinking, how did they spend this much money on the cover? Her name is Lileen Paul, and she's going to discuss her book, The Bees, which is this really cool, I guess it's futuristic, cross between like The Handmaid's Tale and The Hunger Games. But what it does is it talks about bees from the bees' point of view, from the hive point of view. And it's a real tour de force because I don't know how she keeps it up for the entire book, but you're really drawn in, and you find yourself really empathetically creating a relationship between you and these incredible creatures, and of course, which are rapidly dwindling due to causes unknown. But it's a great book, and I look forward to talking to Lileen next week. So thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader. Sam Keen's a really cool author. His book's on our front table, as is Lileen's The Bees, and it's a really cool cover. And you know, we always talk about not judging a book by its cover. This is a cool cover, and when you see it, you're going to want to buy it. So anyway, enough of my rambling, as usual, and we'll talk to you next week. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.